Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Been a while, and probably because of the Iran thing, but Grant Newsham, gracious enough to join us here on a Monday morning. So, Grant, first of all, Happy New Year to you. All the best, and where are you, first of all, on the planet, and how's your New Year going so far?
Well, pretty good. I'm just in Taipei, in Taiwan. But you know, so far so good. Their New Year doesn't start actually till I think later this month. You know, the so-called Chinese New Year.
Does the Chinese New Year coincide with the Vietnamese New Year? Is it kind of an Asian thing that everybody celebrates the New Year at a certain time that we don't really understand?
You're right about the last part. No, I'll plead guilty to that. But I think it's the same thing. It's figured out. They call how you'd hear it referred to as the Lunar New Year,
right?
Chinese New Year, Tet, etc. You know, Tet is a word we all hear,
right?
Are familiar with this age, but the I think it's the same thing, and I think it, you know, somebody figures it out. I'm not sure. I have no idea who, but they figure out what day it starts and then what day it ends. It's not just one day; it goes on for a bit, So that will come up later on in the month. And that's the one that, you know, people do take more seriously. Otherwise, it would be like you and I trying to celebrate the Orthodox Christmas on whatever, January 7th. You know, we could do it, but our hearts probably wouldn't be in it. So.
Right. Do they celebrate our New Year, or do they celebrate the Lunar New Year exclusively? Or is it kind of a mixed bag? Some do and some don't.
I think it's sort of mixed, but as I said, I think the big one is the Lunar New Year, the Chinese New Year. Well, but, you know, there is, December 31st does get a lot of attention, but the one they really like is the Lunar New Year.
Got it. Well, I wonder, it's like the way Americans have embraced holidays like Cinco de Mayo, St. Patrick's Day. I mean, came from other cultures, but are now, you know, why the hell not? Yeah, let's go. Why not celebrate New Year's more than once, right?
I'm with you. I always thought it would be good when I was younger, had Jewish friends, that the idea of Hanukkah with a present every day.
One
sweet racket to me.
There you go. We haven't had you on since major events took place in the Middle East. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on that before we talk about some interesting things going on in the Pacific. And we'll start with Taiwan there. But give me your thoughts on it. Seems like in very, very short period of time, the tables have turned on Iran. They were looking to expand their crescent from the Persian crescent from Tehran all the way to Lebanon. And now, over the course of the last few months, they faced protests in Beirut, Baghdad, and, you know, in their own country. And now the president of the United States, and this is my read, I'll be curious to hear yours, but, you know, he's essentially poked him in the chest and they backed down. He gave him, I played the audio from when Vito Corleone tells everybody, "I'm bringing my son Michael back. And if he hangs himself in a jail cell, or a policeman should shoot him, or if he gets struck by a bolt of lightning, right, I'm going to look at people in this room, and I'm going to come looking for you all." And he's essentially said, you know, anything done by your proxies, I'll take it as something that you've done. And I thought, in, you know, very quickly emasculated Iran, because if the President of the United States decides to sink most of the Iranian Navy or decides to Tomahawk missile the hell out of the Iranian guards, then that risks the franchise in Iran, given the current state of politics in Iran. So I'd be curious about your thoughts on all of that as an intel guy.
Put it in context of almost 40 years, you know, since the Iranian Revolution in 1979, and the Americans have pretty much, I don't want to say done nothing, but they have shown that you can bully them, you can kill them, you can kidnap them, hold them hostage, and the Americans really won't do very much. And that was the, it was a bipartisan achievement on the U.S. side, successive administrations, that there's a lot of talk, but at the end of the day, they really never did anything to bite back or to respond when Iran did these sort of things that, you know, killed Americans. And finally, you get a real estate man from Queens who figures out, well, this is crazy. And he's the one who has done what everybody said, all the experts, oh, you can't do this. You just can't do it. Well, he did it. And it's not like he just woke up one morning and did it. He's got, you know, the people around him. He's getting intelligence. He does have advisors. And he said, well, no, you know, we're going to, you know, if they're going to do this, we're going to kill them. And they took that shot at Soleimani, the head of the Revolutionary Guards, and killed him. And that was an absolute, just complete change of pace. It was out of character for American administrations. And if some guy comes, you know, Trump comes in and says, we're going to do it differently. And, you know, the game isn't over, of course. We have to wait and see what Iran does. But this is, it's like if you've been prodding and teasing a dog for all this time, and then finally he sort of wakes up, growls, and bites you. You start to look at that dog a lot differently. And this is what, you know, if this is, if the Americans take advantage of this, it could be a sea change, just a completely different way of approaching Iran. And it was really, it was quite something to see, not least because everybody, all the experts said, if you do this, World War III will come, blah, blah, blah. The Iranians will do even more to you. But he, you know, Mr. Trump went ahead and did it, and I've got a feeling he's got a list of other things to do. And you can see the Iranians have backed down, apparently, for a bit. But as I said, this isn't over, but it was just, it was first time in 40 years I can think of the Americans actually publicly having done something like this. So that's how sort of much of a shock it was in a way.
Right. No, I mean, it's something the Israelis would do, right? It's not something the Americans would ever do. And Americans would continue to play charades and the emperor's new clothes. And, you know, people would call it everything they want it to. And we would never, ever. And again, you know, Grant knows this, but, you know, that guy had blood on his hands from a lot of Marines that he helped kill with those explosive foreign penetrators. And you know, because, truth be told, you know, shrapnel from artillery rounds was not having the effect on our up-armored Humvees after, you know, we got enough of them over there. And these things that came from Iran were deadly, 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 deadly. And so he had, you know, the blood of a lot of Marines and soldiers on his hands. The and so this is not something that America has historically done. I'm curious, Grant. I don't believe for a second. I'll give you McNamara says a little thumbnail. I believe the Iranians back channeled through the Iraqis or somebody, maybe flew through Vlad Putin and said, hey, could you text the President of the United States, tell him that for internal consumption, we're going to shoot ICBMs into the dirt, right? And these are the grid coordinates. Tell him, please do not retaliate when we launch, as it is from, as this is for internal consumption only. He has our word, we will not harm a hair on an American's head. and which, in spite of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's statement to the opposite, there are too many Shiite militias. There are too many weapons that Iran has at its disposal that if it wanted to strike Americans, that it couldn't do that. I'm curious your thoughts about that.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. It's plausible, and maybe even it's more likely than not. And as you said, the Iranians are able to hit what they aim at, as they showed when they attacked the Saudi oil facilities the other day, or shot down that Ukrainian airliner as well. The fact they didn't kill any Americans, it does suggest that they we're trying to make a statement for internal consumption. That wouldn't surprise me. But does it indicate that they're going to change their behavior in the future? I don't know. But it was a surprise, or not a surprise. I think you can make those inferences, which you have. One other thing, it's an incident that's always, I'm surprised it hasn't gotten any attention in connection with Soleimani. Remember when the U.S. servicemen were kidnapped in Karbala around 2006?
Yes.
It's sort of a terrorist team dressed up like an American security team came in, took them hostage, about three or four or five, and drove them away and murdered them. That was, as I recall, an Iranian job. And, Soleimani should deserve the credit for that. That alone was worth what they did the other day to him, to my way of thinking. But the other part of this whole issue that is particularly interesting is that what do our other adversaries make of that? Particularly, say, the PRC, China, that has been used to nibbling at the edges, to sort of bit by bit, asserting itself, taking over territory, threatening our allies, intimidating, and even trying to crash into U.S. ships, stealing the ship's underwater drones, etc. Any just these limited humiliations. And now suddenly you see a president who's said, I'm going to defend my red lines. So you can bet the Chinese are trying to figure out how to read this change in American behavior. So there's more to it, I think, than just what are the Iranians going to do, but what are other adversaries going to do now that America has actually demonstrated that it will hurt you if you do something to it. We'll see.
Well, I think the biggest impact, the audience that impacts the most is the American audience. It says, whoa, kind of forgot how powerful we actually are. and then, what is it going to take for United States naval warship to defend itself? Is it going to take for one of those Iranian PT boats that constantly, it seems like, drive an attack profile towards the American warship, in spite of being warded off on the International Guard frequency, which is normal, usual, and customary for international operations, and ignore that, and restraint, and then at the last second they turn away. What's it going to take? Is it going to take for them to launch 12.7 ammunition into your ship and to kill people? And at that point, will you defend yourself? So to me, I don't rightly understand that. We have the right to defend ourselves, according to international law. And I think that this, you have people looking around and say, wow, geez, if we could have only stayed out of these nation-building insurgencies, we actually are a pretty powerful country. So I think the lessons are great for our adversaries. Because we do tend to be seen as this inept clawed around the nation, around the world. But I think Americans need to see. I mean, hell, over the course of the last 20 years, the major narrative has been, the inept American foreign policy, how does it get out of these things in some way, shape, or form that it could say, we've done right by the Iraqi people, we've done right by the Afghan people, and we've also done fairly well by ourselves, which is this, you know, quagmire, which is why the Vietnam guys for decades argued, don't get into those kind of wars, because it is America at its weakest. And now, you know, in a very short period of time, all of a sudden we see America, you know, looking at somebody and backing them down and saying, wow, we're not as weak as we used to, as I thought we were all these years. So I find that a very interesting aspect of it.
Oh, I do too. It's, you know, there's a psychological aspect to all of this. And, you know, cause we've got all sorts of hardware.
Right.
And we've got a lot of stuff. But if you're not seen as willing to use it, you know, you kind of appear like the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You know, you got, it looks good, but it doesn't really do anything. But once you, it's demonstrated that, you know, you've had enough and that you're going to protect your interests and the interests of your friends, that's that psychological change, which is as important as hardware in some respects. And that's, you know, hopefully what we're seeing the start of. And you'll see just how quickly you see the effects of that. On, say, the ad behavior of our adversaries, which is ultimately what we want to change. And it's, you know, it's very interesting to see. I've only been waiting 40 years for it. there was a short window, you may recall, after Baghdad was seized in 2003, just for a few months, but the Iranians got really cooperative.
Right.
And then when it became clear the Americans weren't really going to follow through on anything, the Iranians became a lot less cooperative and went on the warpath. But other than that, you know, it's hard to think. I can't think of an administration which has actually stood up for U.S. interests the way this one just did the other day. And in the face of all sorts of opposition on our own side, you know, as I said, this was what Mr. Trump ordered was something all the experts, Republican and Democrat, said, oh, it's one of those things that you just can't do it. And there really is no reason you can't do it other than that the experts say you can't do it. So you know, he did it, and we'll see how this goes. But it was, not unhappy to see it.
Well, and if you look at some of the strategic things they've done, the confrontation with China, I believe, you know, we all believe that was necessary for, you know, for the nation, you know, to see that, and look at how that's worked out. I mean, the American economy is good, Chinese economy not nearly as good, and so we're watching that. And so to me, and the same thing with NATO, putting NATO on notice and say, and you know, as only the President of the United States can, he and his Twitter weapon has probably done more for, you know, the American stance and around the world relative to, you know, what we're paying relative to our military and what other nations pay. So I think that that's a pretty interesting part of this. I want to ask you a question about, you know, hybrid warfare, or, you know, one of the great strengths the Iranians have had over the course of over 40 years has been their ability to conceive of asymmetric events and execute them. You know, the taking of our hostages in the 70s, the bombing of the, you know, the barracks in Beirut, and, you know, the attack. I mean, we can go on about the things that they've done, but they've been so successful at using proxies, at doing things we don't anticipate, thinking outside the bun, if you will. Do you think, given their current political state, that they will be as aggressive as they've had in the past, given the Vito Corleone notice that the President of the United States gave them? What is your sense? I know you don't have a certified crystal ball, but I know you, like the rest of us, you have an amateur certified crystal ball.
Yeah, well, considering until I think today I was on the teams that I wanted in the latest round of the NFL playoffs, I was 0-6.
I know, but you did pick the Washington Nationals to win the World Series.
No, I'm talking about the most recent.
Hey, look, man, you got to take credit for that. That makes you an expert, I think.
Yeah, I think Kansas City won today, so I'm 1 for 7. But the, I don't really see a change in Iranian behavior at a fundamental level. They're going to wait, size things up, and then see what they can do. And you know, if you get a different administration in Washington, it'll get a lot easier for the Iranians. Keep in mind the Obama administration reached that deal with the Iranians that basically gave them, you know, $50 to $150 billion, and an agreement that the we wouldn't do anything if the Iranians waited 10 years before building nuclear weapons. So you get the wrong administration in Washington, and the Iranians could find that, you know, they can go back to doing what they've done. I think the nature of the Iranian regime, like a lot of the, which does resemble an organized crime group, is such that it's going to be very hard for it to change its fundamental outlook and its fundamental behavior. But that doesn't mean that they're not going to have trouble domestically. You know, in Iran, where the economy isn't very good, partly owing to U.S. sanctions, but also just partly owing to it being a regime that sort of steals the good stuff for itself and leaves the average person with a lot less. So how they, whether or not the domestic front in Iran forces a change in behavior, that maybe is the big question. How do you get the domestic front to do that? I'd say even stronger sanctions than you've got going now. And if you can, happened the other day, if you can hammer the Iranians when they do something outside their borders, particularly to us, then there's a tendency domestically for people to say, well, look, it's these the Revolutionary Guards, this regime that is the source of our problems. Let's get rid of them. So there's a couple – what the Americans do does have an effect domestically in Iran, but at the same time what happens there does have a life of its own when people don't have jobs, when things are expensive, when they're unhappy with corruption, lack of opportunity, et cetera. But I don't see a real fundamental change just yet. You know, let's see how this plays out. If the U.S. Can keep up the pressure and get some Western allies to go along with them, and even some other allies to go along with them, that, you know, you keep the pressure on, and you never quite know when these things are going to blow. You know, we'll see. But you know, this is, as I was, it's sort of nice to see this thing, this latest thing happen. But in terms of the long term effects, I think we're going to have to really keep up the pressure and not back down, and in fact, I think attack if we are threatened, like we did, and then see how that plays out. It's been 40 years, so it may take a little while to resolve, I should think.
Let's switch gears a little bit. While all this was going on, Taiwan, its own free nation, with nary a connection to mainland China historically, had a national election. We talked about it a little bit, probably about a month ago, and you made a smart on us. Give us the results of the election and your thoughts on it.
The results were the current president, President Tsai, she and her party won the election. Tsai is sort of what you wouldn't call her pro-independence, but she certainly does not want to be part of China. She wants to continue the status quo indefinitely, whereby Taiwan is effectively a de facto nation. And in her party, there are people who want to formally to be sort of a real independent nation, but she represents the faction that doesn't want to be part of communist China. The other side, the KMT, is a much softer view towards relations with China. So that's, in some ways, that was the referendum, is will Taiwan get closer to China, sort of give up and say, let's cut a deal or let's work out something that acknowledges mainland Chinese supremacy, or do we not? And the side that said we do not won, and they won by a lot. They got about 60% of the vote, a little less than 60. And the other side, the KMT, got about 37-38% of the vote for president. And that's a big victory. If you adjusted it for population, that would be like an election in the U.S. where the winner gets 30 million more votes than the other.
Wow.
And that's a lot of votes, let's say, if you adjust it. In their equivalent of the Congress, the legislature, it was much closer. The Madam Tsai's party still got a majority, which is good, and that's what they needed. But it's much closer, and that's often how it is in those systems where people vote sort of at a national level. You know, they'll vote a certain way, but locally people tend to go with the local politician they know who sort of they think can bring home the bacon or, look after them better. And so, but nonetheless, the KMT, that other party, does have a very, very strong patronage networks at the local level. So it's good. It tells you something that they could not do better than they did in the vote for the legislature. So that's where it is. You've now got, so sort of, I'd say a bullet has been dodged. Because about a year ago, it looked as though Madam Tsai was in a lot of trouble, and her party was in trouble too. But after
Grant, that would be based on what?
Largely economics, okay. And her mishandling of things like national pension reform, in particular, and other things that just weren't popular with a large part of the vote, sort of same-sex marriage, these sorts of things. But I said largely economic, because the Taiwanese economy wasn't in good shape, but really the pension reform, I think, is what really worked people up. Imagine if you were planning on Social Security or your retirement pension, and you suddenly found it had been cut by about half because the government did, and owing to the government's decision. Well, that kind of gets you worked up, I should think. And so that's why she was in a lot of trouble. And then within her own party, because her polls were down, she was getting sniped at by rivals who said she's got to go if we're going to have any chance. So it was considered very dicey, as I say, 9-10 months ago. And then after the events in I'd say Hong Kong saved her and saved the DPP, which is her party, because the people in Hong Kong who wanted nothing more than to be free and went out and sort of protested and kept protesting and still are protesting. That said a lot, but when you saw the Chinese Communist Party's response, that is really what reminded people of what's at stake here for Taiwan. If you don't stick with Madam Tsai, who has been consistent and very articulate in how she sees Taiwan and how it needs to be free, that the thinking was, if you don't stick with her, then you're going to be like, that'd be like you're living in mainland China. And if you try to protest that, what's going to happen to you is what's happening to the protesters in China. And particularly with Taiwan's younger generation, I'd say like 35 and below, 40 and below, those people have got a sort of a nice long life ahead of them. And the idea of having to be part of mainland China that has no appeal to them. On the other side, the KMT, those tend to be much older. Older voters.
Ah.
So it was really Hong Kong that I think did more to bolster Madam Tsai and her party than anything the United States did. The U.S. has done some helpful things in its expressions of support for Taiwan, but it's really just expressions. And so far, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but the Americans need to do much more than they've done. But nonetheless, expressions of support did help. But another side effect of the events in Hong Kong and also the Americans putting tariffs and economic pressure on China is that it made China a less attractive place to do business. And you had a number of Taiwanese companies actually come back to Taiwan in the last year or so. And that has actually sort of bolstered the local economy, which tends to make things better when people feel better about their economic prospects. You tend to credit the party in power. And So that also helped to build some support for Madame Tsai. So what you have is what the Chinese, what the mainland, what the PRC did not want, which was the vast majority of voters in Hong Kong vote for a party which doesn't want to be part of mainland China. And the demographics being what they are, if younger people support that party, over the years there's going to be more of them. And if older people support the opposition, the KMT, over the years there's going to be a lot less of them as they leave the scene. So I think what you're going to have now is the PRC is going to turn up the heat verbally, militarily, and probably try to get rid of Taiwan's remaining diplomatic allies. But that's to be expected. I think this would have happened no matter who won, assuming they did not sort of give in to mainland Chinese demands. But we're going to see that, I think, start up. It could even be tomorrow, for all I know, but it's going to be pretty quickly once the Chinese Communist Party, the PRC leaders sort of catch their breath and revert to form.
All right. Let me I've got a whole series of questions because it's been a while. I want to ask you about China and the agreement that has been tweeted about. What are you most curious to see as this agreement it takes form? You know, it's been much has been made about the major problems that you know that have been laid out in this dispute: American access to Chinese markets, forced technology transfers, and intellectual property rights. So, and these are things that the Chinese economy has been built on. So I'm curious, as you've seen this this quote-unquote phase one of this agreement, your thoughts.
I think there's a couple of things, but one that I'm particularly interested in is how long is it going to take the U.S. side to admit that China's not doing anything that they agreed to do, that the difficulties for American and foreign businesses doing business in China haven't changed. That Chinese behavior, cyber theft, intellectual property, strong-arming, and really strictly controlling how successful foreign companies will be in China. When will America once again say, you know, this stage one agreement didn't really work? I think there couldn't be many people who think that it is going to work, but I'm wondering at what point will we say, look, this didn't work. We're going to try something harsher. And my guess is that with an election coming up in November, that this administration isn't going to be as strict as they otherwise would, and that the phase one trade deal, I think it is for domestic consumption in the U.S. to try and calm things down a bit so it's not a distraction during the election. That would be my guess. And the second thing, and so that's what I'm waiting to see, is at what point does somebody say the emperor has no clothes? And, you know, it'll come, but just when, I don't know. But some things you can predict pretty well, and that there's no agreement the PRC will sign that will cause them to modify their behavior. It has to be, it's going to happen, it is going to have to be because of pressure that is hurting them and hurting the leadership personally. But otherwise, this is not going to amount to much, this agreement. The second thing I'm particularly interested in is will the U.S. Congress ever pass some laws that make it, that prevent U.S. pension funds, public and private, from investing in the People's Republic of China? And I think, and why I say that is because it is, and I've said it before, it is these funds and groups or investment companies are putting so much money into the PRC that it effectively keeps that regime afloat. The comparison would be if it were in the U.S. Civil War, if you had had, say, Wall Street and Northern businessmen investing money into the Confederate States of America while the war was going on. In this case, there's not a shooting war yet, but China does think it is at least at a sort of an early stage of a war, as they see it. But it's certainly not a friendly relationship. But it is this money which is really what keeps the Chinese Communist Party regime afloat. And I'm wondering at what point the U.S. Congress will act on that. And to me, that is key to everything. If they don't do it, then we really are asking for trouble. If they do it, boy, that would be as big a game changer, how'd you call it, be as significant an event as killing the Iranian commander the other day. So that's also what I'm watching for, because everything, all the other agreements and, you know, tariff levels, et cetera, to me, that's just nibbling around the edges. To me, the big thing is, do you get to this foreign exchange, this convertible currency in U.S. dollars in particular, that American companies, American firms, and even the TSP program, in which a lot of government people have their retirement, is pouring money into the PRC, whose stated objective is to defeat us. At what point does the U.S. government wake up and do something about that? Now, that's the other big question I've got.
But you don't think, and I concur with you, in an election year, I would expect us to do, you know, the Texas two-step for a while, and then we'll see what the election brings. But I think the president, certainly the way he orchestrated it and the timing of it, I think he's done more than anybody else has relative to standing up on his own legs. But I honestly, you know, believe that, I mean, there is the, you know, there is an election coming up. And if we can get an agreement, even if we have to dance sideways through the election and then go back to playing hardball, because I don't need to get elected a third time, because it's illegal. But I'm interested too, because again, as we've talked, you know, the things that prop up the and are fundamental to the Chinese economic system are things they have historically never, ever, ever wavered on. And so thinking that they will is saying that, yeah, they will fundamentally change and become what the elder Bush said. Well, once they're economically integrated, of course they'll change. And there's been no indication of that. I want to ask you about, I'll tell you what, for those of you listening, if you want to, Grant's now made a couple of different references to pensions. If you want to do some pretty interesting reading, read about pension solvency, public pension solvency in the United States, and read the situation that states like New Jersey, like Illinois, and just start looking at the problem that Grant's talking about within the United States. It will have your jaw resting on the floor. It will have your jaw resting on the floor. I got an email question from somebody a couple weeks ago, Grant, asking me to ask you about the Army's pivot to the Pacific. Told me that the Army now has a 4-star general out in the Pacific, a 4-star command out in the Pacific, and that the Army wants to compete for Marine Corps roles and missions in the Pacific, and have a closer relationship with the Navy as they pivot to the Pacific. Can you give us any insight on that?
Was this a question to provoke me? And no,
no, it was looking for your insight.
It's a fair question. My insight is the U.S. Army does have a role to play in Asia, but I wish it would stick to its core competencies, to the things that it's supposed to do well first, rather than going to looking to take over the Marine Corps' role. You know, and I've actually seen this firsthand. This would have been in the early part of the 2000s, for example. The Army established something in Japan called First Corps or I Corps. It was a headquarters in Japan. And the idea was to try I had actually a friend who was involved in this. And he said they were laughing at what their intention was to actually get themselves into Japan and take over the U.S. Marine Corps' role. I'm more interested in winning wars than I am in actually the U.S. Army feeling like it's fully employed or doing what the cool guys do. And then what you had, this was in about 2014, 2015, the U.S. Army made its the command at User Pack, U.S. Army Pacific,
right.
Into a 4-star billet. What was the reason for that? To have a dig at the Marines, because then Marines have a 3-star at Mar 4 Pack a few miles away. Now, since the Army has a 4-star, and since to the Army the Marines are ground forces, therefore the Marine 3-star is subordinate to the U.S. Army commander in the Pacific, so the Army claimed. And during this period from about 2015, 16, 17, when the Chinese were really stealing a jump on us in the Pacific, the poor commanders at the Marine Forces Pacific had to spend their time fighting off really this childish behavior by U.S. Army commanders trying to force the Marines to be subservient to the Army. And as I say, this was nothing more than a power grab, and it was, I say, it's a disgrace considering what was going on. And I say we allowed the Chinese to get the jump on us. So as I say, I'm more interested in winning out here or preventing war than I am in whether or not the U.S. Army feels self-fulfilled. You can see I've got an opinion on it. There is a role for the U.S. Army. And
yeah,
that's
who knew? Are you, just for the record, are you seeing a therapist about all of this? You seem to be pretty wound up about this.
Oh, I am about this. You know, when you get bigger problems than, as I say, this the need for self-fulfillment on the part of the U.S. Army. The Army has a role to play, certainly on the Korean Peninsula. It has some niche capabilities, particularly its sort of long-range missile capability. But you look at what they're proposing, and it's very much the role of the Marine Corps. And the Army's presenting it as though they're the first people to have thought of this thing. And as you know, they've come up with this brilliant idea, and they're going to implement it, and goodness knows, because they have these multiple launch rocket systems, the Chinese are probably going to surrender out of sheer terror. Now, instead of the Army coming and saying, hey, this is what we have to offer, how can we work this in? They're coming in and saying, hey, we're the big show in town. Everything, you know, the Army's going to win the war out here, you know, not hardly. But they have a role to play. But I say, you can see over the years, I have been less than impressed with what I've seen of the U.S. Army in the Pacific. And I say it's been a distraction, and it has distracted our attention from more important problems. It does say it has its uses, but I say I've got some real questions about this latest initiative on their part. So if you want to cooperate, fine, but if you want to come in and throw your weight around in the playpen, I'm less impressed with that. So the Marines, that is part of what you're seeing, is this Marine move, a more sort of verbal and more overt alignment with the U.S. Navy, is not just a recognition that this is where we ought to be, but partly it is self-preservation. Not just self-preservation. It's if you want to win a war, you've got to combine that Marine-Navy capability. And that's a historic capability that we've had. And you might as well stick with what works and then bring in extra things that can help you, but not to sort of just upset the whole sort of a system that's worked pretty well for a long time, just to say to make the U.S. Army happy. But they say they have their uses, but if the Army's role is to sort of be a big force that can steamroll an opponent, and that's what you need to get right first. You know, just the and until they have got that down, until it's sure that they can do that, I wish they wouldn't go out and try and pretend that they're the Marine Corps. So
is it just the historical roles and missions thing that we're fighting over?
I suppose that's a nice way to put it. It's more, it's kind of childish. You know, that their army's feeling left out because the Marines get all the attention, and the Pacific is not sort of the hot theater you've noticed at the moment.
Right.
That, you know, because the rise of China, and now everybody, the Army wants in on the fight. Well, there's other places you just might need an army, a big, powerful army, as I say, that can steamroll people. And you never know where they're going to be needed. And you've got to have, say, you have your core competencies down. and get those right first before you take on a sort of some new initiative. And you know, roles and missions, yeah, it's a handsome way of putting it, but it's the sort of childishness that kept the Marines out of the European theater in World War II, the resentment over the attention, the publicity the Marines got in World War I. You know, there's a little less childishness at that level in our sort of military ruling class would probably be a good idea from my perspective. But you can see this, as I said, did you ask the question to provoke me?
Yeah, if I had known that you were that emotional and unhinged about this, I would have asked this a long time ago.
Do I sound unhinged? I think I'm being pretty nice about it. But having seen, you know, the, as I said, the 2014 to 17 or so, and I've seen it other times too, you know, just firsthand, you know, the headaches that the Marine leadership in Hawaii or in the Pacific had to deal with, and I will use the word, with these idiots, over the porch after. It was you'd watch it and you would just say, oh, brother, why don't we just surrender now and get it over with? And so that's how bad it was. And if you said, Newsham, we'll give you $1 million if you put a good face on it, I suppose I could. I give it a good try for $1 million, but I don't think I could succeed.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to fake through these issues, Grant. They're obviously deep-seated issues that you have relative to the Army. But
as I said, make no mistake, when you watch them, when they've got all six cylinders firing and say they steamroll the Iraqis, for example, you know, that sometimes that's what you need. It's what a country like ours requires, is that capability.
Right.
They didn't do a whole lot better. They didn't do all that well in Afghanistan. So a little bit of a post-mortem on that to figure out what went wrong would be good. But so you play to your strengths, you know, and that's the important thing. There's two armies, really. One is the fighting army, and the other is that other part of it. I'm not sure what the Marine Corps' comparison is. Maybe it's the air wing, and the rest of the Marine Corps. But the I really want to stress that, you know, I have nothing against the Army, but I would say there's some of the childish behavior of some of its leadership does not impress me at all.
And this started in in kind of the final phases of your active duty career while you were in Hawaii?
Well, it actually started before that. I mentioned the I Corps, I forget what they call it, but it's this command they put in Japan, 2003, 2004, et cetera. And it was a big deal. You know, the armies back in Japan, yeah, like all 150 of them. But the idea was they were going to be the big dog, and we're going to displace the Marines. And that was the thinking behind it. And as I say, I had some inside information on that. And I was, you know, was really kind of disappointed and horrified that, you know, somebody on our side, we would have one of the services actually thinking that way. I've always been sort of in the what works business and prefer to win wars rather than lose them. But as I keep one of the parties self-fulfilled.
Well, you know, here's what I find interesting about the issue. And what I find interesting about the issue is the same thing part of what I find interesting about the Marine Corps as, you know, as General Berger is going to, you know, put his stamp on it and, you know, in you know, that he published in his planning guidance. And so the question is going to be this. The United States Marine Corps is on the hook for X number of tank battalions, X number of artillery battalions. And so in some of the stuff that you read that we're going to, you know, stand down some of these organizations, you know, you're like, wow. You know, so what is – Congress has a vote. It's not General Berger's Marine Corps. The Marine Corps belongs to the United States. And so so when Congress looks at war plans and says, okay, look, so Marine Corps, you're going to give away XYZ. This war plan, all call for this amount of XYZ. Now, where is that going to come from? And they look at the Army. And the Army says, why are you looking at us? Well, the Marine Corps says, they're out of that business. And then, you know, the Army says, So that's on us to regenerate? We're their lapdog, right? The Marine Corps decides, how about you telling the Marine Corps, no, those war plans require that. You cannot give that up. And so I think it's very interesting. And so to me, what's interesting about the Army's pivot to the Pacific is this. Hey, we already have somebody out there doing that. Okay. I don't know that we need a second amphibious force zooming around out there when we really haven't been that great at creating the first one. Although we all see the need, if this is going to be the primary theater in the next 100 years for the United States, we all probably see the need, the Pacific, to pivot in that direction. But what would be logical, reasonable, and sound to do as the Army as a complement to the Marine Corps and the United States Navy in the Pacific? But it doesn't even sound like we had that, and now we're just gonna go like steal marbles off the table and play those kind of stupid games. Yes,
I wish I could say it was otherwise, but that's certainly how it looks to me. Wow. You take your analogy.
Right.
You know how on a MU ARG, if the MU commander and the Navy guy, his counterpart, if they decide they're going to get along and act like adults, things really go smoothly. And when they decide they're not, one of the two is not going to, it's a disaster. And so much does depend just on this basic willingness to cooperate that you'd think you'd see more of it at those levels in the U.S. services. But it seems the older they get, the closer you get to being about 8 years old, as often as not. It really with what just some basic willingness to cooperate, figure out how to get this done. I think you'd have no problems at all, but boy, once one side decides it wants a bigger helping of the pie, or that it wants to be doing what the cool guys are doing, that things get very difficult. Remember when nobody wanted to be an insurgency or a counterinsurgency guy? Nobody wanted to do that. Except for a few eccentrics, and I was one of them. And then once the 9/11, after that, suddenly out of the woodwork come all the springbots, sort of come out of the woodwork, and they're all now everything's low intensity conflict, insurgency, et cetera, et cetera. That's going to be the war of the future. Forget the big stuff, and they just wait and see what happens now once we start having problems in the Middle East, assuming we tend to have problems in places we don't expect. But now the hot Pacific is the hot theater and everyone wants to get there. But the other rest of the world tends to come and sort of tug on our pant leg unexpectedly. And, wait till it's, the fight is in Zaire or the Congo. Suddenly everybody's going to rush over to the latest to the fight. Wherever that is, to where the cool guys are doing stuff. And then it'll switch back. It's like children playing soccer. Well, they all chase the ball.
Right.
And so we'll see. So I'm, at some point you get old enough to have a little bit of experience. So I'm, I wish we would cooperate a little more than we do and maybe look at the whole map. Is my way of thinking.
One would think Congress would force that, given the dollars involved in.
Once Barry Goldwater left the scene, I think our chances of that probably reduced proportionately. It really takes some scary guy on Capitol Hill to bring these 8-year-olds to heel, I think.
Got it. All right. Here's another one. I was reading late last week about Malaysia's use of the UN, and the article was called Lawfare, as in warfare, and it talked about how Malaysia was using an expansion of the economic exclusion zone to extend out 200 miles to combat, and it was being successful at the UN, and that all these nations, that Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines were now looking at doing what China had been relatively successful at. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I'll have a go at it. The simplify it is that China, as we know, has pretty much laid claim to the entire South China Sea.
Right.
Countries like the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, and even Taiwan, they all have their own claims to the South China Sea as well. But China, since they're China, they've said, we don't care about your claims, it's ours. But one option that you have is to go to the sort of a UN tribunal and ask the UN tribunal to rule on it, say, well, what do you think? You know, you're the impartial third, you know, the third party. And then if the tribunal gives you a ruling which says, well, you know, you're right, China's claim is wrong, you will then have their ruling. And you can take that for what it's worth. You know, try to do something with it, but it's good to have. You know, the Philippines have, you know, got that successful ruling from the Permanent Court of Arbitration, is what it's called,
right.
And in 2016. And the Chinese, of course, ignored it. And the Americans, you know, to do China a favor, didn't raise the issue either, which was a mistake. But China, so the Philippines has this ruling in their favor, and it's something you never quite know when you're going to be able to use it, you know, push it. It embarrasses the PRC, et cetera. So the China would prefer that the other claimants not go to the UN to submit their claims for adjudication, but mostly because it makes them embarrassed. You know, China does try to claim it's a responsible member of the world community, but yet when the the body that represents the world community says China is wrong and China refers to their ruling as a piece of trash paper, that it you know, even China, you know, they're like people from New Jersey. There is a point at which you can embarrass them. And China does have a point at which it can be embarrassed. So what Malaysia did is it's had this claim sort of on hold for a long, long time. They finally said, okay, we're going to put it in for decision by the UN body and see what they say. So what you're doing is you're telling China, you know, we don't care what you think or what you claim. We're going to go defend our interests. And that's where it stands right now. What it is you have a considerable nation in ASEAN that has decided that it's going to push back a bit on China. Will it affect Chinese behavior? Maybe not by itself, but you know, it's one, you know, if you're one piece of the puzzle, you know, if you keep pushing, you know, trying to restrain or shape Chinese behavior, it's one sort of obvious and hard to ignore step on the part of the Malaysians, and that towards that end, and you know, and so it's significant. And it is important because the previous Malaysian regime was basically bought off by the Chinese. But the new regime is a lot less bought off and has done some things which have indicated a willingness to push back against China. So it is, you know, when you hear that it's Chinese domination is inevitable in Southeast Asia, not necessarily. So I think that's, to me, that's the significance of what the Malays have done.
All right. Next question about North Korea has done some saber rattling of late. The United States was supposed to get a Christmas gift from Mr. Kim. If we got one, it would be very, 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 very well hidden under the tree because I did not notice it. Talk to us about that dance, and then just what yesterday I read that North Korea had said that the United States had been deceiving them for the last 18 months relative to these negotiations. So, could you get your again secret decoder ring out and explain to us? Is this just more of the same? Pay attention to me, and again, I think that I don't know that that Mr. Kim would look at what happened in Iran and say, that's interesting, but that's interesting to consider that as well. So, Give me your thoughts on those.
Yeah, I think it is more of the same. You know, one advantage of, you know, like you having watched this for 30-plus years now, is you kind of get used to North Korean behavior and tantrums and the threats. And the threats work better on some administrations than others, and pretty much on every other administration they work pretty well. But they, you know, in this one, they kind of call their bluff, North Korea's bluff, and they, so you, yeah, and you find that, well, there wasn't a Christmas present yet. So that, I think, to me, that was predictable. But where I am concerned about the North Korea thing is that the, you know, over time, it won't be tomorrow or next year or the year after probably, but they're gradually improving their nuclear capabilities, miniaturizing it in particular, and also their improving their delivery capabilities. And that's really an engineering question, engineering problem that you've gradually figured out. And they're getting support, and have been from the beginning, from China, Russia, and even Iran. The Iranians and North Koreans have been cooperating for years on missile development. And over time, you know, they, you know, you can ignore the North Korean bluster and the threats, but once they, at some point, you wonder at which they're going to get a system that is so good, able to go so far and be so accurate that, you know, they could slip one through. And at that point, you know, the, it gets a little harder to laugh at these kinds of threats. And you, you know, president, future president, just might feel like he has no choice but to deal with an immediate threat, what he perceived threat, the way he did with Soleimani the other day in Baghdad. So over time, this is going to get a lot worse. I think this will get worse. But for now, you kind of knew that the Christmas present thing, I was really curious to see what it was going to be. And I think on maybe in retrospect, that on reflection, that the North Koreans may be thinking, oh, maybe it's good we didn't do something, given what the Americans did the other day. So that was just my sense of it. You know, we've heard all of this stuff before from the North.
All right. So nothing that breaks squelch relative to anything new, or just more of this kabuki dance we've been doing with them.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Does China, you know, you talked about how, you know, North Korea doesn't do anything without China's approval. The Chinese economy is not it has not done well, and it's been interesting to watch some of the things written about you know, the Chinese requirement for a deal with the United States as their economy struggled. Is Kim keeping a lower profile in any way, shape, or form, being dictated by Beijing as Beijing seeks to calm the waters, maybe get an economic agreement or execute an economic con job with the United States?
Well, I haven't seen that. You know, I say I just haven't noticed it. There was a little news reporting the other day that China had, I think, cracked down on commercial transport near the Korean border, with the suggestion being they were cracking down on sanctions or on the amount of goods that go into or out of North Korea. But we've seen that many, many times before, that that you may see a little show of activity on the Chinese part towards restraining the North, but I haven't seen any indication that leads me to believe they're really serious about it. In fact, other reporting suggests the North's sort of regime's position isn't all that, it's actually not that bad. You know, the economy for North Korea is, you know, I don't know, you've only got 1,000 people dying of starvation a day instead of 10,000. It's hyperbole, but, you know, so I don't really see any indication that the Chinese are doing us any favors with the North, you know, at all. It's just my reading of it. Their Chinese economy is definitely slowing and has some problems. It's always hard to know exactly how to read those things or to assess them, but certainly it's slowed, and Chinese behavior, official Chinese behavior, statements, etc., do suggest that they know they've got a problem as well. Will the thing collapse? I don't think so. But it, nonetheless, if you've got a slower economy with a lot more people without jobs, that causes you some concern, even to those kind of regimes.
Interesting. Interesting. All right. What are you writing about? What is what's broken squelch for you, and what are you going to have to say about it?
Oh goodness. like everybody else on the planet, at least who follows this stuff, I've had to write a couple things about the this fellow named Carlos Ghosn.
Yeah. How about that?
The head of.
You and your love of Japanese organized crime and all the rest of this, that's right up your alley.
It is, the difference being you can't distinguish organized crime from the Japanese ruling elite in this case. But it's just sort of, it's a real, from a liberal arts perspective, it's fascinating examination or observation of how, let's say, Chinese ruling class, that elite class, how they behave when they feel like foreigners have gotten too big for themselves. And so essentially what happened here, the readers may not follow it quite like I have, is that Ghosn was the head of Nissan. Ghosn was sort of pushing or going to allow Renault, the French company, to take over Nissan, as it was legally entitled to do under a shareholding arrangement. And the Japanese, they say that ruling class, did not want a foreign company to take over one of their national business champions, Nissan, like our Ford Motor Company. So they basically trumped up charges against Ghosn, lured him back to Japan, arrested him, kept him in solitary confinement for 120 days or so. And were interrogating him 8 hours a day on average without a lawyer and giving him sort of the treatment like Jimmy Doolittle's captured pilots probably got, after the Doolittle raid. And this is you read it and it's really fascinating just because you're seeing sort of scraped off is this veneer of civilized behavior. When the Japanese ruling class feels itself threatened in this way. So Ghosn escaped the other day from Japan. He was out on bail, and somehow he got out of the country. He's in Lebanon, where he's part Lebanese.
Right.
And so just gave a press conference the other day.
But some of the things that I've seen about this story, which has been very interesting to kind of watch, it's one with the aid of an American Green Beret, but supposedly his passport was in the possession of his lawyer, and he was wearing either an ankle bracelet or his house was being surveilled by the Japanese. Some type of federal police or something like that. How do you pull it off, Grant?
I think apparently the surveillance he was under, it was I think it was who was it? Mo, Larry, and Curly appear to have been the guys doing it, the Three Stooges. But it wasn't quite as strict as you would imagine. And he had an extra passport. I don't know if it was a French one, but I think the French embassy may not have been averse to making sure he had a passport. And he was able to get out of the country. I haven't. How he got out, everyone's still talking about it. And it's interesting. But to me, the more interesting thing is how Japan Inc., that ruling class, how they act towards foreigners. And how they act when they're embarrassed, which is about like a 5-year-old when he's told he can't like have ice cream for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's sort of Jimmy angry. And that's about as much as the thinking that you're going to find on Japan's elite now that they've got it in for Ghosn. But in some ways it's funny, but in other ways it is more serious. And I would suggest that they, and I'm actually sort of writing something up on it, that the more serious part of this, and it gets very little attention, is that at the same time Ghosn was arrested, some would say taken hostage, I would say that, that he, an American, another Nissan executive, was taken hostage at the same time. He is still being held in Japan, and he was held under solitary confinement too in the interrogations. You can imagine the Japanese prosecutors demanding he confess and admit his crimes as a Yankee air pirate or something like that, which is how nutty these people are. But they've got an American who's still hostage, and they're holding him under dubious circumstances. And this, I think, could become a nation-to-nation issue, if you think about it. And I don't know that Japan's sort of government understands the risks they're taking. Because you take an American, you hold him hostage. We don't like it when the Iranians do it or the Russians do it. And I don't know that we're going to like it any more than when an American, when Japan's only ally, us, takes a hostage either. And if I were to talk to Abe, I would tell him, you had better get this guy out of Japan, back to Nashville, where he's from, and just hope the whole thing blows over. I would imagine Mr. Trump may have an issue in this, should he learn about it. And that's gotten almost no attention, is this remaining American guy who's being held hostage. He's out on bail, but he can't leave the country. Japanese court cases, this could easily take 5-10 years to resolve. His wife came to Japan to be with him on a student visa. She's studying Japanese lessons, which got her the visa. So it's something that when the Japanese government, if they decided they didn't want a French company to take over Nissan, they should have prevented it some other way. Hostage taking has more to do with what the Barbary pirates used to do, not so much what a G7 country does. But boy, you can, if Japanese elite hear this, you will, of course, get the Jimmy angry response. So the next time I go to Japan, I'll probably get arrested too. But I've got a piece coming out. Now, once again, you try to explain things, but also be constructive, and you try and head off a more serious problem by doing some easier things than waiting till the thing really explodes. And you ask the everyday American, do you mind if Japan has an American hostage? And I think they might say no, and they're the ones who vote. You know, the so-called alliance managers and the people at State Department who are willing to sacrifice somebody for the larger good, they only have so many votes. I would say the average American has like 50 million more votes. So I wish somebody on the Japanese side would pay more attention to this. But once the bloodlust for revenge hits these people, they kind of go nuts sometimes. So we'll see. But that's one of the things I'm working on.
All right. Anything else on the horizon in the Pacific that you have your eye on that I wasn't smart enough to ask you about today?
Well, I think the big one is Taiwan. You know, we kind of celebrate for a day or two. But I'd say if you've got a seatbelt, or if you've got a shoulder harness, I'd strap it on. Because I think the Chinese are going to try to scare us, but we'll see. But we'll see how that goes. And I say I'm trying to mentally go from top to bottom in Asia. But no, I think the Taiwan was a big enough.
Is it possible that the United Nations will become a foil for China in a very, very public way in these disputes as these nations come before the United Nations and say, please, you know, China's conducting war against us. Please stop it.
I think the way those decisions are made for these individual countries in Southeast Asia, they're made by smaller branches of the UN, for want of a better word. So that's why you can get an honest result. If it's something in the General Assembly, where every nation has a vote, China has bought off so many of these that they can actually get through the United Nations or get amount of support that allows them to do an awful lot of things. You know, that's why, for example, criticism of their human rights record or their treatment of Muslims, of their own Muslims, it gets that the UN has not really been critical of that the way it should be, because these, a lot of these little countries have, you know, God, they're on China's side, which money will get you a lot of things, and that's really what's going on. So the UN is in a, you know, we think we've always been a little skeptical of it, but it's, you know, given Chinese influence there, it's, I think, well-deserved skepticism these days.
Got it. All right. I just thought that it's kind of interesting in that the way that the one of the mechanisms would be publicity, right, in front of the UN, and you know that the Chinese not real fans of either one of those things, and so being embarrassed when they're, you know, and I would liken it to, you know, the Iranian situation that happened when they shot down the airliner last week. You know, the initial stories that you hear was, you know, Iran is not going to, you know, would not release the black boxes. It will not accept responsibility. It did not initially admit that it did anything wrong. Then all of a sudden you saw, you know, in relatively short order for the Iranians, a statement that said, yes, we shot them down. It is our responsibility. And almost a halfway decent explanation about what happened. So it's almost like the Chinese finding themselves in the same, you know, what we can stand here and require the world, you know, play emperor's new clothes, and we'll be ridiculed for it. And but maybe the stakes aren't that high, you know, for some issues, but for China, maybe, it is. And so being ridiculed in front of the world and maybe is the, one of the appropriate techniques in terms of how to deal with that.
Oh, you're really onto something. You should let Washington D.C. know that. but you really are. It may not be the UN where you're able to do it, but there's a lot of other ways to do it. And they don't. There's that question of embarrassment that really is part of the equation in PRC thinking. I think as Americans, we're pretty much immune to embarrassment. But to the Chinese, it really bothers them. And if they played right, as I say, it's a useful sort of lever to have. And you know, say there are a lot of opportunities for it. The General Assembly, of the UN, pretty much manages to embarrass itself these days, but you know, for a long time. But the as I say, there's other ways to get those points across.
Interesting. All right, Grant, first of all, always enjoy the conversation, whether we're talking about your ability to pick sporting events or all the other things we talk about based on your background as an intelligence officer and your many years in the Pacific. So whether it's the American New Year or the Western New Year, Happy New Year to you, and thank you for doing this.
Okay, pleasure, anytime.
All right, there he is, Grant Newsham, on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't touch that dial, because this program is about to repeat itself. That'll do it on Monday. Post-traumatic winning down at Camp Pendleton today with my favorite wing support squadron. Yeah. Marine Wing Support Squadron 372 down at Camp Pendleton. Going down there, and I was guest speaker at the ball, and I'll just tell you, I just they've been great to me. I received a few emails that have talked to me about people looking forward to me coming down there. Yeah, how about that? And so looking forward to it. If you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. In hour one, what you're going to hear is some of my thoughts about last week in North Carolina with Second Maw, and then and a day with Second Marine Division. But I have some thoughts on that. I mean, I've done this now for a year, and I'll share those with you in the first hour, and then I also share no personal information, but I share a couple messages, you know, with everybody today, and the reason I do that is to point out to everybody how many destroyed families are in this country, how much bad parenting there is in this country. And there's so many young people in this country that are adrift. And if they will come up as somebody in their teens or their 20s or their 30s to somebody who's in their 60s, because somebody told them that they've gone through experiences that maybe they have, because somebody extended a hand to them, then I'm here to tell you, all of us should do that. All of us should take some time and reach out to young people, because there is a lot of young people in this country, based on my experience, that need somebody to talk to. And they're people that don't have any, they don't have what we would diagnose classically as mental health. And that is, you know, being bipolar, schizophrenic, you know, manically depressed. They're overwhelmed by life, and they need coaches, right? They need coaches, and we got to get better coaching. We got to become better coaches, and that's all there is to it. And to Marines that are on active duty, how you think, especially staff NCOs and officers, how you think that you can't hold a formation in which the senior enlisted Marines of that company see the Marines of that company with all that experience, right? So that they can know that PFC McNamara, who runs his mouth every day, all of a sudden isn't talking. And we're asking novice leaders who've been in the Marine Corps less than 5 years, many times, to see that and do the right thing. Well, I'm here to tell you, it ain't happening. And I cannot believe that people think that the reason we have formations is the password. That's not why. There's a thing called the sixth step in troop leading in the Marine Corps. It's called supervision. And if you don't supervise, the other five steps don't mean shit. So if you're not holding formations, you got to see them. I would tell you a minimum of twice a day. Got to see them in the morning and see them in the afternoon. That's how you find out that bad stuff's gone on in their life. And if you won't do that, then you are part of the problem. You're part of the problem, and you need to go away. Okay? Because because passing information via text message and not seeing your Marines, that's straight up wrong. So anyway, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. On a Monday, All Marine Radio, over and out.